It's a Christmas edition of Tuned to Yesterday, bringing you holiday programs from the golden age of radio. I'm Mark Levoner. In this hour, we bring you Rudy Valley in one of his many incarnations on radio, though still a host of a variety show, and that is the Royal Gelatin Hour. This Christmas episode from the 23rd of December, 1937, on the NBC Red Network.
The Royal Gelatin Hour, directed by Rudy Valley. The night star, Ethel Barrymore. Hi-ho, everybody. This is Rudy Valley and Company. Our best holiday greetings to a jittery universe, or rather to that portion of same within reach of our wavelength and in tune therewith. To take your mind off the newspaper headlines that seem to have little to do with peace on earth, goodwill to men these days, we have prepared an hour as merry as we can make it. Merrymakers include Ethel Barrymore and Dudley Diggs in a scene from the Theatre Guild play The Ghost of Yankee Doodle by Sidney Howard. Oliver Wakefield, representing Merry England, in a serving of old English nut pudding. Lou Sorin, in a sketch bringing to radio for the first time, the great Hyman Kaplan, hero of a well-known comedy series in the New Yorker magazine. Irene Sherwood, sales girl from the haberdashery department at Macy's, representing Christmas from the other side of the counter. Tommy Riggs and Betty Lou Barry, who join us to say,
Merry Christmas to you and everybody, so there, too.
Our sisters, our gentlemen songsters, and yours truly, Santa Claus is coming to town.
Santa Claus appears no harm.
Along about Monday, we had what seemed to be a brilliant idea for this week's personality interview. A notion packed full of good old Christmas time human interest. Why not, we said, interview that bright particular holiday heroine, the average shop girl, the poor, overworked wretch who stands on her feet all day behind a counter and takes the Christmas rush on her chin with a smile. The type Joan Crawford plays in the movie. Poor but honest, sole support of a large family, including a weak-chinned brother she's putting through Princeton. That sort of thing. Picking Macy's huge department store as a likely hunting ground, we went in search of our average or Joan Crawford type sales clerk. The result was astonishing. We found out she doesn't exist. Either Macy's or the movies must be wrong. However, we went ahead anyhow and picked out a girl who seemed to us to represent the average New York department store sales girl, the real thing as opposed to the Hollywood version. Her name is Irene Sherwood, and she enters now. Miss Irene Sherwood, sales clerk, shirt counter, menswear, Macy's, front and center, please. Your age, Miss Sherwood?
21.
And your place of residence?
Brooklyn.
What part of Brooklyn?
Flatbush.
As nearly as we can determine, ladies and gentlemen, all sales girls live in Flatbush. Also, they all take courses at Columbia University, and most of them seem to be candidates for a master's degree. You are taking courses at Columbia, are you not, Miss Sherwood?
Yes, of course. In English literature.
How many nights a week does that take up?
Two, and one night a week I devote to social service work at a hospital.
Evidently, selling shirts doesn't particularly tire you out.
Selling shirts is fun, Mr. Dallas.
Why?
Well, you meet such interesting people.
Yes, I suppose everyone, sooner or later, has to buy a shirt. Miss Sherwood, from your observation of Christmas shoppers, do you think most people are happier at this time of year, full of Christmas spirit and all that?
Well, they certainly don't look happy.
Well, how do they look?
Grimly determined. They look as if they were thinking, come on, let's get this over with, especially the men.
Do you prefer to wait on men or on women?
Men. They're much easier to please quickly.
You think a wife can successfully buy clothes for her husband?
Yes. If she buys what she's been told to buy. Sometimes women have ideas of their own. Then the husband comes back next day and says, look, all I want is a white shirt.
Men, you would say, have generally more conservative notions about haberdashery than women do.
Oh, very much. Except that older men seem to go in a great deal for bright-colored shorts and pajamas.
Why is that, do you think?
Well, I suppose they're getting a little bit desperate.
That, I should say, is a cryptic remark. We won't go into it any further.
What color pajamas do you wear, Mr. Valley?
Plain white.
With a monogram on the pocket?
No, why?
Well, most celebrities do.
Maybe you have a theory about that, too.
Yes. Famous people, especially theatrical celebrities, are extremely name conscious. They like to have their names on everything because, subconsciously, they're afraid someday their names will no longer be in the headlines.
Interesting, if true. But let's talk about you, Miss Sherwood. Why that course in English literature, for instance?
Oh, just to improve my general cultural background.
So you can sell more shirts?
Well, it might help. As a matter of fact, Mr. Valley, my work in the store is not confined to selling shirts. I get shifted around all over the men's store. Don't look now, but they consider me something of an expert on formal attire.
As an expert, how would you rate my own evening ensemble?
I'd give you an A-plus on that get-up, Mr. Valley. Where did you buy it?
In Gimbel's basement. As a matter of fact, Miss Sherwood, it's a custom-built job. Here we are, off the subject again. What is your ambition, Miss Sherwood? Do you cherish a career in department store work, or does your interest lie in another direction?
Well, I'll stick to Macy's, if the store doesn't mind. I want to be a stylist someday.
What's a stylist?
An expert who interprets style trends, giving direction to the store's buying activity in her field.
Sounds like a good job. Thank you, Miss Sherwood. We are indebted to you for an interesting 5 minutes.
No one, Mr. Valley, is indebted to Macy's.
And you tell Macy's, Miss Sherwood, that if you don't get a raise out of that remark, I'll buy my saxophone players at Bloomingdale's hereafter. Also, Merry Christmas.
And a Merry Christmas to you, Mr. Valley. May I show you something in church?
Thank you. Thank you.
I forget the crowd and the loud rumble of cars and all the bright lights turn into stars. There is magic on Broadway when you're smiling at me. Magic my heart never knew. Oh, what a joy, blissfully wandering. Those blossoms on Broadway with you.
The report of the Ways and Means Committee, please. As one who was there opening night, if you come to town, don't miss Edwin's Hooray for What. Down with Love from Hooray for What.
Down with love, the flowers and lights and shoes. Down with love, the root of all midnight blues. Down with things that give you that well-known pain. Take that moon and wrap it in cellophane. Down with love, let's liquidate all its friends. Moon and June and roses and rainbows end. Down with songs that moan about night and day. Down with love, yes, take it away, away. Always take it away. Give it back to the birds and the bees and the peonies. Down with eyes romantic and stupid. Down with sighs, down with Cupid. Brother, let's stop that dove. Down with love.
Arise, you blighted lads and jilted James. Arise, you sighing saps in lover's lane. Arise, you guys in Reno's hills and dales.
Arise, you guys in alimony jails. Arise, arise.
Don't forget your trusty swords and custard pies.
We're out to tar and feather love like father love and mother love.
And even want a brother love.
All is vernal love, autumnal and eternal love.
So down with evening journal love.
Hail, hail, the new day's here. Who are Jack and Jilly love? Cottage on the hilly love. Garbo love, gable love.
Under Tony's table love.
Russian love, Parisian love. Also Polynesian love. Yeah, bravo! Down with all this middle class devotion. Yeah, down with all this bourgeoisie emotion.
Down with love, the flowers and rice and stew. Down with love, the root of all midnight blues. Oh, down with things that give you that well-known pain. Take that moon and wrap it in cellophane. Down with love, let's liquidate all its friends. Moon and June and roses and rainbows then. Down with songs that moan about night and day. Down with love, yes, take it away, away, away,
away,
away.
Take it away.
Give it back to the birds and the bees and the peonies. Down with eyes romantic and stupid. Down with sighs, down with Cupid. Brother, let's stuff that dove. Down with love.
Ethel Barrymore and Dudley Diggs in a scene from The Ghost of Yankee Doodle, current Theatre Guild success. To John Steinbeck's of Mice and Men and Clifford Odette's Golden Boy, we are proud to add tonight this fine play by one of America's great dramatists, Sidney Howard. First, because it is a fine play, and secondly, because it gives us an opportunity to present Miss Barrymore, first lady of the stage, and Dudley Diggs, a gentleman who, after 25 crowded years in the theater, can justly be called one of the first character actors of his day. The Ghost of Yankee Doodle concerns itself with the fate of an upper-class American family of liberal political ideals. caught in the whirlpool of the next war. However, because of the limited time at our disposal, we concentrate on the personal story of the two main characters, presenting Ethel Barrymore and Dudley Digg in The Ghost of Yankee Doodle. Twenty years before our story opens, Sarah Garrison was a prominent Broadway actress. Among her persistent and numerous admirers offstage was James Madison Clevenger, rising young newspaper publisher. Sarah refused Clevenger's advances, married Paul Garrison, left the stage. Now, so many years later, Sarah is a widow, head of a prominent Midland manufacturing family. And Clevenger is America's most powerful publisher, owner of a string of mass circulation newspapers, a famous, fabulously successful public figure. Flying to Washington, Clevenger is grounded in Sarah's city by a snowstorm. He calls to see her, finds the old attraction revived, learns that Sarah's family fortune is endangered by the imminent failure of the Garrison factory. Sarah does not know he has found out about her desperate financial straits. Our scene, the opulent drawing room of the Garrison home, the evening of Christmas Day. Having dismissed the family in his usual imperious fashion, Clevenger addresses himself to Sarah.
I've got the Booth Tarkington background, sir. Fine old American house, more than adequate income from a nice little family business. Call no man master, no, not partner even.
Oh, why did I let you into the house this morning?
To see what I'd be like after all these years.
Well, I've seen. You haven't changed much. 3 hours of you have put me 3 years nearer my grave. You come hurtling across the continent in a plane and drop down out of a blizzard, and for what? You've done nothing since you came into the house but jump from bright object to bright object like a baboon.
That's my vitality I'm famous for.
Vitality is God's gift to lightweight. I suppose no one ever called you a lightweight before. I was thinking of you a few years ago in Italy, in Milan. They were having a public dance competition, and we went to pass the evening watching it. And the prize was won by a dapper, elderly Austrian nobleman. Winning dance prizes was his life's passion, he told us. His name was von der Stolz. Do you remember that name?
He was the Austrian prime minister who wrote the ultimatum to Serbia and started that other war back in 1914.
Yes. It's when one sees leaders of millions like von der Stolz and you, Jim, that one's heart grows heavy for trusting humanity. I wish you'd go on to Washington and leave me in peace.
Sit down, Sarah. There. That's better. You know, it's just exactly as I knew it would be to see you again. Like Napoleon coming back to Josephine.
Oh, no. I wouldn't be good in a part.
You were in love with me once.
Oh, don't I remember?
Well, I thought you would, but I didn't expect you to say so.
Oh, that belongs to the past. I'm involved with the present now.
You don't fit in here, sir. All this isn't for you.
You know, you waited 20 years for your chance to patronize me, and I won't be petty enough to spoil your fun. But you forget that I was put on the stage before I was 6 and got my picture of life from the plays we played then. And they were nice plays about nice people who lived in big houses, in peace and security.
Is that any excuse for living out here on the sticks?
You call it the sticks? I call it America.
That has the sound of civic-mindedness.
Oh, you should know that I'm too lazy to be civic-minded, except about the symphony. I do work on that. I fall innocently in love with all the conductors and make them engage Rachmaninoff every season.
Yes, I remember your weakness for music.
Oh, you never shared it.
Oh, I don't know. And when I tell them how wonderful you are... You remember Julius Anderson?
With the greatest affection and pleasure for her sake, though, not because you bought the ticket.
What have you done with your great gifts, Sarah?
I've lived the life I wanted to and liked it, and found out a great many things that you wouldn't know were important. How pleasant an evening can be alone with a long book and a great deal of coffee. What a mistake it is to carry a watch, because no time matters except time to oneself. I've been singularly and completely contented here.
You never regret what you gave up for me?
Aye, correctly. I never regretted you.
Why didn't you marry me, Sarah?
Oh, Jim, how boring. You haven't thought of me for years.
Now I've seen you again.
Oh, that's pretty cheap of you.
Well, now, we were in love. Why didn't you marry me?
Well, if you must go digging into the past, you never asked me to marry you.
Oh, well, you can't be right about that.
I am. grand, though. The idea was to add my latchkey to quite a collection. I had my own waiting line at the box office then. I didn't see myself standing in yours after the play.
But I did ask you. I remember.
The night I told you I was marrying Paul, I didn't count that. The gong had already gone.
You never cared for your husband as you did for me.
Oh, that isn't true.
Well, you only married to get away from him.
That's really annoying, Jim.
You never married again after he died.
What does that prove?
Well, don't the happily married always try it again?
Oh, all this wit and wisdom. I hasten to think, though, that I didn't have chances.
You should have married me, Sarah. I could have given you all this and more.
You couldn't have given me any of it. And if you've turned up here today for no better purpose than to sort over your old valentines, I'm awfully sorry, Jim, but I'm just not in the mood.
No, I'm not here to sort old valentines. I'm here because once I'd got safely down out of this storm, I thought of the curious gift you used to have for putting me straight almost in any dilemma. You know, you're still the strongest and clearest person I've ever known.
What am I expected to say to that? That I'm afraid I've become just a mousy widow lady? I haven't. You go on to Washington. We've dilemmas of our own here.
You and I share the same dilemma, Sarah.
No, I doubt that somehow.
As people of property, we're both concerned with self-preservation.
Not in the same sense, though. I've been through that once today already and solved it, what's more.
Sarah, come with me to Washington.
Why should I even consider?
Now, whatever opinion you may hold of me, and you are pretty clear about that just now, I'm just as clear about what I feel for you.
Well, that's all the past, Jim. Can't we keep that out of the present?
Well, there wouldn't be any present without it. We shouldn't be here in this room without it.
No, we're not going to stay in here any longer.
Marry me, Sarah.
Oh, that's bad manners, Jim. All those people in the next room. It's Christmas, Jim. Let's join the party.
On a white Christmas and... I can't make love to you as a young man could.
You're not doing badly. That white Christmas was very nice.
I've seen the life you've made for yourself, Sarah. All the strength and sense and privacy of it. And I see my own life as I've lived it without you. No center to it, unsettled and frantic. Aren't you the least bit sorry for me?
Not enough to prescribe myself as a sedative.
History might have been different if you'd married me, sir. Heaven help me, what is it I lack that I can't win you?
I find it hard to believe in vintage romance. But you were a very attractive young man, Jim. I told you you hadn't changed.
You weren't being very complimentary when you said that.
And I might so easily have been. Is it conceivable that I'm being tempted?
Why not?
I shall be very sure, shouldn't I?
You can be sure of me.
I might be using you as a way out, though. That wouldn't do at all.
A way out of what?
No, it doesn't matter. You're wonderful weather for flying today, Jim. After yesterday, almost miraculous.
Why didn't you tell me about all this, Sarah?
This what?
I know about the factory, Sarah. I have ways of knowing things. You're cleaned out, aren't you?
Well, if I'm cleaned out, it's what I've chosen to be. And little cat on your part would have told you I might be sensitive on the subject.
I own a newspaper in the city. As a newspaper man, I make it my business to pry into anything that's of interest to me. Don't you see that this is the end of the world for you, Sarah?
That's just the trouble. It isn't. I'm healthy and I've still a long time to live.
With me?
Oh, why didn't you go last night?
If I had, I should have missed what looks like a good opportunity this morning. Yes, Sarah, to reopen my suit for your heart and hand under circumstances which, to my practical mind...
Look at him with his head up and his tail over the dashboard.
You don't like being taken advantage of.
Oh, did you think I would?
Rise above it, Sarah. Say to yourself, I'm fond of this man who's dropped back into my life out of the sky and come to care for me a second time. And it's to the best interest of all concerned that I should marry him as soon as feasible. Then put on your hat and coat and we'll go and get the license.
No.
Sarah, I could go into court and take my oath on the president's 15th century Dutch Bible that you want to say yes.
But how could I be sure what I feel for you when I'll be flying in the face of Providence if I don't take you? Why didn't you drop down out of the sky a month ago? I could have seen you clearly and humanly there with my life before me as it would have been if all this, as you call it, hadn't happened. I'd have found myself here alone and... my trips abroad going longer and longer and winding up in a world cruise in a white serge suit. I'd have seen that my function here was ended and jumped at the chance of a new function with you. But now, just as I have to give everything up, you offer me a suitcase full of millions and a way out of everything I let myself in for. How can I trust my feelings for you?
If I say I'll take my chances...
No, it's no good. Come back in a year. If you've got to care for me twice, you ought to be able to work yourself up into a third time. And if I've made a success of my hat shoppy or whatever I do decide to turn my hand to, I'll be less confused. But it's no good now with all this round my neck. So go on if you're going and leave me to lie on the bed I've made for myself alone.
Oh, Sarah, my Sarah, you are mine, you know, and I'll be hanged if I let you go. Will you do something for me?
What?
Kiss me goodbye.
Well, I don't see there's any harm in that.
Goodbye, sir.
Goodbye, dear.
WEAS, New York.
We think it only fair to repeat that the scene from Sidney Howard's play, just presented so charmingly by Miss Barrymore and Mr. Diggs, is incidental to the main theme of the drama. Every thoughtful citizen concerned for the future of his country in a world at war would do well to see or read the entire play. The Royal Jealousy Hour, Act Two. Act Two begins on a note of utter confusion in the person of Oliver Wakefield, who is loaded to the gunwales with words of Christmas cheer, a burden which he feels he simply must work off on the general public. Here's Oliver. Don't take him seriously for a moment.
Hello, everybody. In case you don't realize it, Christmas draws on. And very soon you'll have your Christmas ties on. Very, very strong things. Christmas ties and family ties and the old man generally ties on of beauty. And everything goes with a terrific. And I don't see any reason why this Christmas shouldn't go with a terrific if you can look into your honestly and say that you've left no stone unmailed early to avoid and unwrapped every parcel carefully to avoid and gone home sober early to avoid any misunderstandings that might arise between you and the old and have you stopped to think that there's only one more shopping day till Christmas? And if you haven't, of course, it's too late to do anything about it. But as I always say, Christmas begins at home and ends up where you least expect it. Some of you will be spending Christmas in the bosom of your family, and some of you will just be spending Christmas. Because there are many ways of spending. But I think the best way is to spend it on or about the 25th of September, October. No wonder we make such a fuss about it. After all, Christmas is just one of those days. And when you come out of the days, round about 4 o'clock in the after having stuffed your turkey and everything, that the all important question arises: how to amuse the kidneys? A kiddie. It's really a very important question. Now I find that kiddies are very, very easy to entertain. Simple things amuse them. I simply dangle them by their knees. Dandle them on my hands and knees, and I play ride a cockeyed horse to Banbury with bells on. And I really think the best of the whole bunch is that game when a little boy leaves the room and he doesn't come back till he gets what he's after. And most of you know what little boys, and then you send out another little boy, and in that way you get rid of quite a lot of these little boys. Of course, the little girls, on the other hand, aren't frightfully keen about this. So you have to do something about it. So you tell them a story. Nice, clean, you know. None of those little Audrey. Something on the order of Little Red Riding Pants. I think I've had a great deal of success with my little red riding. I build it up to the part where she runs in, trips over the doorstep with a couple of baskets under each, and she says, "Hello, Grandma. What great big false teeth you have." And that's where I fool them, because they aren't false. You see, they really do belong to Grandma, because in my story, the wolf had been at the door so long that Grandma got a little fed up, and she ate it and sort of bites her, you see? And she got rather tired of waiting for Little Red, who was wandering uphill and down Bloomingdale's and fooling around with Gimble's basement looking for Rudy and his... And everybody probably had their eye on her basket, you see, and it's really awfully jolly if you stop to think of it. And the little girl simply loathe it. So what do? They toddle off to find the little boys, and you toddle off to the nearest for a quick. And in that way, of course, a toddling good time is had by nobody in general, and everybody in particular. Because in these days of competition, you must be particular. Now, Rudy, for instance, found himself a little tied up the last three or four, and he asked me to do a spot of Christmas shopping for me. He told me to go ahead and use my own judgment and said he'd give me carte blanche. Now, I don't mind shopping for anybody, but I don't see why I should have to carte blanche around. I mean, I don't mind taking his fair girls off his hands, okay, but in this day, I mean, now it's a question of taste. You know, occasionally you say to yourself, I mean, people clap you on the back when you've got your hand in your pocket. It makes you feel hail fellow all wet. And I don't know, it's all very well to live your life as you like it, but the question is, can you take it? Now, the one message I want to convey and the one thought I want you to keep uppermost in your this festive is that you can't butter your bread at both ends and burn your candle in the middle and expect to get something out of your wife and life.
Coming in old Chicago. I've taken a fancy to you. It took but a glance and I knew there's something about you that pleases the eye, makes me sigh. I wonder why. I've known you forever, it seems. You've shown up in all of my dreams, but now I'm awake and my dreams have come true. I'm full of romance and I've taken a fancy to buy all you. Tonight it is our privilege and pleasure to introduce to the radio audience for the first time an astounding personality, the great Hyman Kaplan. Hymie is the hero of a New Yorker magazine series by Leonard Ross, recently published in book form under the title The Education of Hyman Kaplan. It is necessary to explain that he is a plump, middle-aged, and admirably earnest student in a night school which prepares ambitious immigrants for the duties and privileges of American citizenship. Mr. Kaplan's notions concerning the English language, his unbelievable yet blandly logical distortions of spelling, grammar, and sentence structure have endeared him to many thousands of readers. To play Jaime, we have chosen Lou Sorin, a master of dialect currently featured in the new musical, Three Waltzes. Lou Sorin as Hyman Kaplan. The scene, Mr. Parkhill's English class in the American Night Preparatory School. The class is now in somewhat informal session. Each student has written on the blackboard, at Mr. Parkhill's request, a letter to a friend. Mr. Kaplan, first to finish as usual, is chatting with his friend, Mr. Bloom, as less brilliant performers complete the task. Finally, all seated, the teacher speaks.
The class will please come to attention. Is everyone finished at the blackboard? Has everyone finished his letter to a friend?
Mr. Parkhill, I'm ready.
Well, then we'll have the letters read from the board. First,
my dear Mr. Tuckfield, is it possible maybe I could interrupt?
You have a question, Mr. Kaplan?
Well, yes and no. Me and Mr. Bloom is having a discussion about how it's better to conjugate the verb to fail. I am saying it's one way, he's saying it's another way.
Well, how would you conjugate it, Mr. Kaplan?
I am saying fail, fail, bankrupt.
I'm telling him it's wrong. It's better to say fail, fail, failed.
Mr. Bloom's answer is correct, Mr. Kaplan.
But how is that, Mr. Parkhill? A man has already failed and is not bankrupt.
You see, Mr. Kaplan, to fail is a regular verb, and to find the past tense and the past participle, you merely add ED to the verb. Is that clear?
Why, your explanation is clear like gold, but...
Well, let's take another example. Suppose you give the principal parts of love for me.
Love, marriage.
No, Mr. Kaplan. It's loved again. Love, loved, loved.
You mean it's loved twice?
Yes.
Well, I'm having that in mind, Mr. Potfield. But I'm thinking that love twice is maybe bigamy.
I think we better get on to the regular assignment for the evening. We'll take your letter first, Mrs. Moskowitz. Your subject is what?
Mrs. Moskowitz is reading twice? Well.
Sure, Kaplan. Ladies is twice, no?
In education is no sex difference. Everybody is equally.
Please, Mr. Kaplan. You'll have your opportunity later. Mrs. Moskowitz, if you will begin, please.
Thank you. I am writing a letter about the vacation in Miami, Florida. Which I'm never having, of course. The letter says, My dear Balangaska, that's my husband. When you are having this letter, you will be knowing I am already in Miami, Florida. I ask her if it's hot here like anything. My cold is already improving. Listen, Oscar, you shouldn't forget to give milk to the pussycat. And ask Mrs. Blitz to leave out the pussycat in the afternoon. You know animals. They need exercise. Goodbye, Oscar. Remember what I'm telling you about the pussycat. Your darling wife, Mrs. Moskowitz.
Thank you. Are there any corrections?
Mr. Puckio.
All right, Mr. Kaplan, you're first.
Well, Mrs. Moskowitz is writing a letter about the vacation in Florida, and she's not saying something about the beautiful country down there. Maybe it's better she should call the letter Mein Pussycat.
Well, are there any other corrections?
Mr.
Yes, Mr. Bloom?
In no place is Mrs. Moskowitz having capitals and periods. The beginning from a sentence must be the capitals and the end the periods, no?
That's right. Anything else, Clarence? Well, if not, let's go on with the next letter.
Maybe I should read my letter, Mr. Fakir.
Mr. Kaplan, yes, but please remember the word is pronounced letter, not ladder.
Oh, I am understanding is letter, not ladder.
Very well. You may read your letter, Mr. Kaplan.
Well, my letter is to my brother in Warsaw, and the letter says so. Hello, Miss. I should tell him about my progress. In school, I am fine. Making some mistakes, natural. Also, however, doing the hardest exercises like the best students he says. Some students is Mitnick, Bloom, Moskowitz, no relation to Moskowitz in Warsaw. Next, you should absolutely come to New York and belong in my brother's school. Do you feel fine, I suppose? Is all okay? You should begin right now to learning about okay. Here you got to say okay all the time. Okay the weather, okay the potatoes, okay everything. How's down tennis long should you leave? So long, with all kind of enthusiasm, your animated brother, Heinz.
Thank you, Mr. Kaplan. Now, class, we'll have corrections. Just a minute. Class. You first, Mrs. Moskowitz.
Bill? In all places where Kaplan says mine, M-I-N-E, it's wrong. Should be my, M-Y.
Correct.
So, is Moskowitz correcting Kaplan? Well.
All right, Mr. Bloom, you're next.
Mr. Kaplan got so many mistakes, it's practical wholesale. He spelled wrong the word progress, some, and natural, among others.
So, is practical wholesale mistake, Bloom?
Sure. You say, how is Fanny long should she leave? Leave is meaning to go away. You should write live. L-I-V-E.
Honest to goodness, Bloom, you're certainly improving in your English to seeing all these mistakes.
Thank you, Mr. Kessler.
I see more mistakes.
No, it's here, listen.
Absolutal is wrong. Should be absolutely. Also, okay is wrong. Should be capital O, period. Capital K, period. What mistake?
I certainly giving the class plenty of work, no? Of course, I am hoping everyone is learning from the mistake, maybe.
Oh, and another mistake I see.
Miss, my mistake.
Mr. Kaplan put 3 exclamation points after the name Max. That's too many.
Pardon me, Miss Nick. The other directions you're making is fine. First foot. Even okay. And I mean okay with capital and period. But better taking back about the 3 exclamation points.
Why should she take back, Heflin?
Yeah, I think I'm making good correction. Is it not so, Mr. Parton?
Why, yes. Proper punctuation for the salutation or a comma.
So an exclamation point is not useful, Mr. Parton?
Well, Mr. Chaplin, it's not customary to use it for a personal letter. But if you must use an exclamation point, then, as Miss Mitnick says, 3 are too many.
3 is too many for the way I'm feeling about my brother?
That's a good answer.
It makes no difference how you are feeling.
It may make plenty difference. Of course, I'm not mentioning names, Mitnick, but some people don't care about their family, maybe. But I love my brothers.
But Kaplan, 3 exclamation points.
Of course, Bloom. He is my favorite brother. For my favorite brother, you're asking 1 little exclamation point?
So why not?
That I give to strangers.
Well, I see another mistake.
Oh, yes, mistake?
Yes. How's about the word enthusiasm? It's spelled wrong. Should be with T-H.
Well, you got right. Good correction.
And also, you shouldn't sign with all kinds of enthusiasm. It's dead ending for a letter.
Well, maybe it's all wrong to spell it. But it's certainly all right the way I am using enthusiasm.
Why?
Because I write to my brother in Warsaw with real enthusiasm.
Of course,
maybe some people don't feel much enthusiasm for the family which they are leaving behind in the old country. I am not mentioning any names, Miss Nick.
Please, Mr. Kaplan. I have no family in the old country.
Is that so? Yes. Well, maybe that's why you cannot understand my enthusiasm.
Well, animated is wrong. Your animated brother, Heinrich. It's wrong.
Yes, animated is quite out of place in the final greeting.
Well, I looked up the word animated special. It means full of life, no?
Yes, that's right.
Well, I felt plenty full of life when I was writing the letter.
But, Mr. Chaplin, you may say she had an animated expression or the music had an animated refrain. But one doesn't say animated about oneself.
So, Mr. Puck, you think it's too much?
Yes. Suppose we try another word. How about your fun brother, Hyman?
Now, let me think. Fun. Your fun brother, Hyman. You should pardon me, Mr. Pacquiao. You don't have the feeling.
Well, then what about the word dear? Your dear brother, Hyman.
Well, let me think again. Dear, your dear brother, Hyman. Also, no. Dear, that's too common.
Well, then, what about the word...
Wait, don't tell me, Mr. Pacquiao. Now I got him.
Oh, fine.
Perfect. Such a voice.
You thought of a word, Mr. Chaplin? What is it?
Magnificent. Your magnificent brother, Heine.
Oh, but the
boy is wonderful. No, Mr. Chaplin, I'm afraid not. Magnificent isn't really appropriate. Well, I'm afraid that's all we'll have time for tonight. Class dismissed.
Chaplin,
wait for me. Okay, Bloom.
Tell me, Chaplin, how did you find such a beautiful boy like that?
You mean magnificent?
Yes.
Magnificent. Ah, Bloom. That was a beautiful voice.
Believe me, Kaplan, it is the best. But how did you find such a voice?
By deep thinking, Bloom. By deep thinking.
Thank you. trifle not to love and trifle not with fate. Life is so short and love is all I'm thinking. Love comes but once and then perhaps to
finish 1937 in something resembling a blaze of glory. Please watch your newspapers for our announcement of important visitors. May I remind our Manhattan audiences that the Valley Company opened today at Lowe's State Theater here in New York for the week's engagement. This is Rudy Valley bidding you all good night.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
The Royal Gelatin Hour on Tuned To yesterday from the 23rd of December, 1937, on the NBC Red Network. And on a producer's note, the last 5 minutes or so of that broadcast was edited out for this episode of Tuned To yesterday, mostly because it was unintelligible. As the tape went on, it got a real muddy, muffled sound, and all of my best efforts at noise reduction and brightening up that sound were actually in vain for this recording. I cross-referenced it with other copies that we have in our collection and elsewhere, and pretty much that is what has survived from radio's yesteryear, so really, I would question if even the hardcore fans would be able to listen through that and enjoy it. But I'm in no way questioning anyone's love for these old programs, and we do appreciate hearing from you throughout the year. Here at Tuned To Yesterday with your likes, your dislikes, what shows you would like to hear more of or a little less of, it all helps me figure out what to bring forth from our archive of about 15,000 broadcasts from radio's golden era. From 1931, I believe our earliest recording is from, through 1962. So send me an email. Let me know. My address is mark@wrvo.org. That's Mark with a K at wrvo.org. And be sure to visit our website, wrvo.org, for the latest schedule, which, if you aren't caught into this, it's published a month in advance, so you can really plan your listening around all of your favorite programs, especially around this holiday season, where we try to insert old favorites and bring you new stuff as well. So again, visit our website, interact with us online and through email. Also, if you missed any part of this broadcast, we have these posted just about a minute after they've aired live on WRVO. Again, found on the web at WRVO.org. So that is it for this hour of Christmas on Tuned To Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. And until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVonier. Thanks a lot for listening, and happy holidays.